All right. So today, as I alluded to in the prayer just now, we are going to be discussing something again that is that many people disagree on. I don't find a lot of disagreement specifically on this particular thing that we'll talk about today, but there may be that I haven't heard. We have the we're looking at the Olivet Discourse in Mark chapter 13. And we've gotten to verse 14. And so looking at the PowerPoint here, we've gotten to the point where we are considering the destruction of Jerusalem or the destruction of the temple. And I do believe that this is very relevant here in verse 14. And I think it's very clear in the passages as we'll go through today that this is indeed what's being talked about. The destruction of Jerusalem, particularly the destruction of the temple. And so today we're going to be talking about the abomination of desolation. Now, that is a phrase that if you're not familiar with the phrase, with what's being talked about in the scriptures, that's what is that? What is Jesus talking about here? What possible meaning could this have? Well, as you'll note, if you can see it on the screen here, there's a lot of references to Daniel because Jesus says, well, let's look at the passage. We're going to look at verse 14, and we're actually going to read. Well, yeah, let's just read verse 14 for right now. Well, let's read 14. Yeah, 14. So. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Okay, and so he continues on and says, don't dawdle, go. And so that's going to be the next point that we're going to talk about in just a second. So keeping in mind, of course, the context, he's talking about, he has been talking about, let me remove my face here for a second so you can see, he's been talking about the deceptions that were going to happen in that time. He's looking at the wars and rumors of wars and the earthquakes and the famines that are going to happen, the persecutions. The gospel will have spread to all nations, and don't think about what you're going to say, because the Holy Spirit will give that to you. And so we understand that this very clearly has taken place in the first century. I mean, the gospel to all nations. There's no clear. Well, there is clear evidence of that in the scriptures, but unless you knew about that, like in Colossians 1:23, then you might not have believed that. So. Looking at Colossians 1:23, we see that the gospel has spread to all nations. And so this is the context of the first century. And so there's no reason at this point to think that there's any kind of flip. So we're seeing in this passage the abomination of desolation. And so the reason why we're looking at Daniel is because Jesus mentions or quotes from Daniel, and he's actually quoting from three places in the book of Daniel. So he brings up this discussion, and again, it's mentioned in three places, and I have them up here. It's Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, chapter 11 and verse 31, and chapter 12 and verse 11. And I have some others in there that I plan to reference in our discussion on this particular topic. So the abomination of desolation. I believe, and I seek to prove that today, I believe that the one in Daniel chapter 11 is not what Jesus is talking about here, because I believe there are two different abominations of desolation. Abomination of desolations. What's the plural of that? Well, anyway, and I think the text is clear with regard to these particular abominations of desolation. We're going to go with that one. The one we're going to mention right now is Daniel chapter 11, and so that one is one that had occurred in Jesus's past, and so we're going to look at that a little bit. Daniel 11 overall. And so when we look at Daniel 11, so I'm going to turn there now. Daniel 11 is a prophecy about the period of that happens after Alexander the Great. So if you remember, Daniel is a book about four kingdoms primarily, and we see a good chunk of it takes place during the Babylonian Empire and that kingdom there. The second one, part of it takes place during the Medo-Persian Empire. We see this in Daniel chapter 2, and it's made more explicit later on, Daniel 7, I think, 7 or 8. And we see the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persians. And then the Greeks come around, and of course that's Alexander the Great. He conquers the world, and he spreads Greek culture and the language, the Greek language, and that's the reason why the New Testament's written in Greek. And so, Alexander the Great takes care of that. Well, Alexander the Great, if you remember from history, dies pretty young. Well, after the Alexander the Great, there's the Roman Empire, and that's not mentioned specifically in the book of Roman or the book of Daniel, but we see that it's through history that the next empire that come about is the Roman Empire, and so that's that we can see that in history fairly plainly. And so the book of Daniel is about these four kingdoms, but after Alexander the Great dies, he dies pretty young. He has no plan of succession, so his kingdom is divided up into four major parts, four smaller parts of his empire. The two that really matter to us in terms of studying Bible history and the history of this takes place, all this takes place is prophesied and takes place during the intertestamental period between the last inspired work of the Old Testament and John the Baptist in the New Testament. So all these things take place and are the and are yeah these four kingdoms, and the two that we're mainly concerned about that surround Palestine were the Seleucid Empire in the north. And so whenever it says King of the North, it's talking about the Seleucid Empire for the most part. There is one later on where he's talking about the Romans, but for the most part he's talking about the Seleucids. And the king of the south, he's talking about the Ptolemies in Egypt. And so Egypt the Seleucids are in the area that we know as Syria. Okay? So they continually fight each other, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. They continually fight each other, and the Jews were often caught up in the middle of all of that. They didn't and in fact, they are a very strategic location. I think I mentioned that in a sermon a while back. This is a very strategic location. And the land was so frequently fought over by these giant empires to the north, the Seleucids, and later the Romans, and to the south. At some point, there is one called Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, and he is one of the Seleucid kings from the north. And he is a king who was a bit mad with power at some point, and he came back from a humiliating loss against the Ptolemies, and he wrought devastation in Jerusalem and in Palestine in that area. He even out at that by that point, he even outlawed Jewish religious customs. He demanded that Zeus be worshipped in the temple, and he even had a pig sacrificed on the altar. And so this is what we understand to be the abomination of desolation in the first one that's historically in Daniel chapter 11. And we see that in verse 31. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. And so that sounds exactly like what we see in history. This occurred on, according to history, occurred on December 6th, 167 BC. So 160 or so years before Christ, This abomination of desolation happens. And we can read about this in the Apocrypha. If you decide to read the apocryphal books of the Old Testament, you can read about this. And if you can look it up online if you don't have a copy. In 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 54, and in 2 Maccabees chapter 6, verses 1 through 11. I don't want to take the time right now to read those because, there's some pretty awful things that go on, and it pretty much repeats what we've been talking about here. And in fact, the Jews called the Greek god Zeus a desolating abomination. And so, because Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes decided to say that, hey, only Zeus can be worshipped here in this temple, that was an abomination, a desolating abomination. And so we see that this is that first one that's talked about in Jesus's past. So we really want to focus on Jesus's prophecy here. And so, but we have to understand that there are three mentions of an abomination of desolation. There are two different kinds. The first one, of course, is what we just talked about. So the question becomes, if this occurred in the past for Jesus, why is Jesus talking as if this is yet to come? Were they wrong to interpret Daniel's prophecy as having happened in 167 BC? Well, we find that they did not. I don't think that they didn't misinterpret the one in Daniel 11. But again, recall that there are two other mentions in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, and chapter 12, and verse 11. So let's see. In all three, we see that sacrifices will be taken away, but there are certain time elements that are added in the other ones, in Daniel chapters 9 and 12. In Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27, we find that what's called the 70 weeks prophecy. The 70 weeks prophecy. And this starts off talking about the Messiah who came and who died on the cross. We find in verse 26, he was cut off, but not for himself. And so that's a prophecy about Jesus and the fact that he was crucified. So let's look at that 70 weeks prophecy there in verses 24 through 27. Now, it may sound like a few verses, but it's actually quite a bit. And we can't go through all of it today. I don't plan to go through all of it in this class, but mainly to focus on the ones that focus on the discussion that's germane to the Olivet Discourse. All right, so 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the fourth of the command, that, excuse me, that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. Ah, there it is. Even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. So we find here in this particular passage in verse 27, not the abomination of desolation per se, but the abomination shall be one who makes desolate. So this is what we might understand to be the abomination of desolation. And so we find, so one of the things that we typically understand in the book of Daniel, and in particular in this particular prophecy, that the word that's translated as week is not meant to be understood as 7 days. This is really 77s. And so these we find this is talking about 7 years. A week in this prophecy is talking about 7 years. So 70 weeks in this case represents 490 years. 490 years. So the covenant would be confirmed. We find that here with many for 1 week. So a period of 7 years. And in the middle, 3.5 years, he puts an end to sacrifice and offering. Now, how does he do that? By giving himself, right? There doesn't need to be any more sacrifices and offerings because he has given himself. Jesus has given himself to be the final sacrifice and the final offering. There is a space between that and the remaining 3.5 years of this week that culminates in the destruction of the temple in AD 70. So there's most believe that there is a break, a small break in the 70 weeks in between the time when the Messiah is cut off and the destruction of Jerusalem. 3.5 years prior to AD 70, in late AD 66, something happens that starts this chain of events. Roman soldiers surrounding Jerusalem. This time frame also reflects Daniel chapter 12, verse 11. So let's take a look at that. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 11. And we'll look at 11 and 12 as well. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. So again, some very specific time elements are mentioned here. So this time frame, 1,290 days, is about 3.5 years. Wow, look at that connection there. This is what he gives from the abomination of desolation to the destruction. So to confirm this, let us consider what the other accounts of the discourse have to say. This is a this is I could just be making this up, but we need some biblical confirmation for some of this. What is this abomination of desolation? So let's consider, so it's mentioned, the Olivet Discourse, as I mentioned before, is mentioned in both in Matthew and Luke, as well as in Mark, like we've been talking about. And so in this particular thing, Matthew's is actually very similar to Mark's account here, talking about the abomination of desolation. If you want to understand, look at Daniel, and then flee to the mountains. So, but Luke's has a slightly different audience. The Mark is written to Roman Christians, but Roman Christians had some Jews who were there, Jewish Christians who were there, who might be able to explain what this abomination of desolation is. But Luke was written to an individual, a Gentile named Theophilus, and so he might not have access to understand what the abomination of desolation is. So he is explaining this to under to help Theophilus understand what Jesus is talking about here. And so we see that that what he's talking about is in verses 20 and 21. Excuse me, I need to mention a chapter. Luke chapter 21 is the Olivet Discourse there. And we find that in verses 20 and 21, the mention, there's no mention of the abomination of desolation, but there is, we can see the context around here that he's talking about the same thing. So he says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her." Okay, so what's he talking about here? We can parallel the differences between Mark 13 verse 14 and Luke 20, 20 and 21, 20 and 21. Ooh, that's a lot of 20s. We can parallel these things. Just prior to fleeing the mountains that we see in the last line of Mark 13, 14, and in Luke 21, verse 21, we see that just prior to fleeing the mountains, Mark's account says that they were to see the abomination of desolation. Luke's account states that this flight should occur right after they see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, making no mention of an abomination. But we do see that Luke mentions desolation, then know that its desolation is near. Well, why would they need to be told about this? So again, this is very clear. Clearly, this is looking at the parallel accounts and trying to understand all this. It's clear that the abomination of desolation is Jerusalem being surrounded by armies. But we have to expound upon that and try to understand that a little bit better, I think. Why would they need to be told this? Why would they need to be told to flee if Jerusalem is surrounded by armies? At the same time, if a city is surrounded by armies and about to be besieged, and you can escape, common sense says escape, doesn't it? Common sense says get out. But that's not exactly how things happened. When we study history, we can understand, at least according to what Josephus writes in his books, and I'll cite some of what he says in a second. The truth is that there is General Cestius, and I guess I'm pronouncing that right, at least according to how we would in English. General Cestius, he began a siege in late AD 66, in November of AD 66. And he was recalled, however, after the Jews in Jerusalem were about to surrender. And Josephus has no idea why Cestius was recalled, but he was recalled, and this was right at the time when the Jews were about to surrender. Because of this reprieve, the Jews saw this as a sign from God that he would bring them the victory should they come again. This isn't without precedent. Hezekiah, Sennacherib from Assyria, Sennacherib came down and at some point just left. And Hezekiah was amazed at this and was willing what was you know that was the Lord's doing because Hezekiah was a righteous king and because of the again Sennacherib had just left. And so this was not without precedent. And Judah was saved. The kingdom of Judah was saved at this time. All right. The Christians, however, excuse me, hold on, let me back up a second. The Jews often had a conceited notion as well that God would protect them no matter what. And that is not unusual in history as well. Even when Judah and the Jews were being wicked and not being faithful to God, they believed that God was on their side. No. You may be the chosen people and God may save a remnant of you, but you're still going to suffer quite a bit if you are unfaithful to God. And so that's what we see in history. The Christians, however, they remembered Jesus's warning here. They remembered and they had the books written so that they could read it. If they had forgotten, they could read it and they could understand. And so they took this opportunity to get out while they could. An historian later called Eusebius records that no Christians were killed during this event, during the destruction of Jerusalem. And of course, as I mentioned, this calls to mind the people of Jeremiah's day, who thought God wouldn't let them be taken into captivity. At least, if they did, only it would only be for a couple of years, and it wouldn't be for very long. Many resisted this, including King Zedekiah, and those who resisted were killed, despite Jeremiah's pleadings that they go along with Babylonian rule, and as a result, they would live. The Jews of the first century were no different. Jesus was telling his followers, as Jeremiah told the Jews of his time, if you resist, you will be killed. In Jeremiah's case, he tells them to submit. In Jesus's case, he tells the Christians to flee, to get out of there. Desolation that these armies would bring would be far more devastating than anything Antiochus the Fourth and Epiphanes threw at them over 200 years before. The city was sacked, the temple was destroyed by order by Titus later on, General Titus, not the preacher in the Bible, a different Titus, under orders from Emperor Vespasian to end the conflict. We see how this brings desolation, but the question is, what part of this is an abomination, strictly speaking? Well, Daniel chapter 9, verse 27 tells us that the abominations shall be one who makes desolate. So whatever it is that brings the desolation is also the abomination. Well, if you think about it, what was the religion of the Romans? Well, they were pagan idolaters, were they not? They surrounded the city with their idolatrous symbols that they carried with them on their as their standards, as their on their shields, all over their insignias, and in fact they're called these things are called ensigns, at least in all the things that I found, they're called ensigns. And so looking at one of those, they were often in the shape of an eagle. Let me move my face out the way. Often in the shape of an eagle. And this is, I think this is from a movie. this particular capture. I don't know. I just tried to look for one that looked that fit what I was trying to show. And you know, the thing is, no one really knows what they look like, but they knew that they had an eagle on them. And so, and some of them, at least at this time, no one knows what they look like. There were some that they could find here or there, but most of them were taken or stolen and dealt with that way. But Daniel, so let's see, these were pagan idolaters. Okay, so these were in the shape of eagles and aligned with the Roman god Jupiter, the Roman god Jupiter, and symbolized the Roman Empire and her armies. If you remember, Jupiter is the king of the gods in the Roman pantheon. And Jupiter, of course, is the Roman equivalent to Zeus, and in the Greek pantheon. So if you remember studying Greek mythology at any point, you'll know that the Romans pretty much took all of their mythology from the Greeks and changed some names. They didn't even change Apollo's name. He's the same. But for everything else, they changed, for the most part anyway, they changed their names. They changed Zeus to Jupiter. And we find that this is a symbol of Jupiter, a symbol of Zeus, the same pagan god whom the Jews called the desolating abomination in the second century BC, if you recall. So there is a connection here. This actually fits with the latter part of Daniel 11, when the prophecy shifts to discuss the Roman Empire. So looking at Daniel 11, verses 36 through 39, it actually shifts a little bit to talk about the Roman Empire. And we find there one of the passages, let's see, actually a little bit from 36 on, but I want to focus on a particular phrase in verse 38. But I'll start in verse 36. Then the king, Daniel chapter 11, verse 36, then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a God of fortresses, and a God which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign God, and he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. So this is a prophecy of the Romans coming in. And an interesting phrase here, he shall honor a god of fortresses. He shall honor a god of fortresses. The Romans, essentially, they didn't, they were religious to an extent, but especially the military people, they more worshipped their military might more than anything else. And it was evidenced by these standards, by these ensigns, by these eagles that represented the Greek or the Roman god Jupiter, their king of the gods. They shall honor a god of fortresses by doing this. So when they see this happening, it's time to go. It is time to go. All right, and we can see that here in the next passage. And I think we might be able to cover this. Look at the next couple of verses here in Mark chapter 13, because now it is time to go. Verses 15 through, what do I have on my notes here? 15 through 18. Let him who is on the housetop not go down into the house, nor enter to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter, for in those days there will be tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the creation. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped ahead. So verses 15 through 18, and pray that your flight may not be in winter. So there is a sense of great urgency that Jesus brings here. Don't wait, don't hesitate, just go. Most ancient houses back then, they had a flat roof with steps on the outside of it. So if one is on the roof for whatever reason, he could easily leave his home without having to go down inside of it. So he would have to go outside and come back inside to get whatever things, but Jesus is saying, no, do not do that. And being on the roof, he may have had a good vantage point, seeing the Roman armies coming to surround Jerusalem. This is the same for those in the field. It would be easy to spot the Roman armies approaching and know that it's time to go. It would be especially hard on pregnant and nursing women, as I'm sure many of you know how difficult it is for such women to move around with their unborn or newborn babies. And in fact, even today, when a woman gets to a certain point in the pregnancy, they're asked not to travel because it's very difficult on them. And they could deliver at any moment. So, of course, a winter flight would make it even more difficult to move due to the cold. Now, Cestius, as I mentioned earlier, came through in November of AD 66, which could lead into winter. But thankfully, they had 1,290 days before they really had to leave. Titus would return later, however, in July of AD 77 to begin the siege, which lasted until September 3rd of that year. About 45 days. As Daniel said, it lasted from 1,290 days to 1,335 days. Ladies and gentlemen, that's 45 days. That fits the prophecy so exceptionally well. And it's amazing what confidence we can have in the scriptures that if Jesus says something is going to happen, if the Bible says something is going to happen, it happens just the way that he said it was going to happen. This is about 1.5 months, we see in Daniel chapter 12 and verse 12. And the tribulation that they would face would be quite difficult. Let's see, do I have time to look at the tribulation here? I don't think I do. So what I'll do right now, Sam, is I'll pitch it over to you if you have any thoughts that you'd like to share on this. Love to hear them.
Sure. I think it's sort of like what I mentioned Wednesday night. There's a lot of things that are hard for us to understand because we have incomplete historical records, right? So we're making our best estimates based on the history that we've read. There's lots and lots of sources. We haven't necessarily read them or studied them all. Some of them have solid backing. Some of them are just made up stories. There's some of that in, especially in the Middle Ages, there were lots of people who made things up and said they were written back in the first century when they weren't. So the best thing to do in these situations is one, take the scripture seriously, and two, always realize that we're looking at it through kind of a foggy lens when we're trying to match up history. One thing for sure, Jerusalem was destroyed. The Jewish nation was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. The priesthood was destroyed. And the end of the Jewish nation and the Jews being any semblance of God's people all happened in that time period. And they had their opportunity. They had 40 years of the gospel being preached. They had crucified the Messiah. So that kind of stuff we don't have to worry about. That kind of stuff is rock solid. It's easy to understand. The scripture tells us very plainly. When we start mapping up things into history, it's always a challenge. And so we take our best shot. And I think that's what anyone has to do when they study it. You're only going to have certain sources, and you're going to read your sources and spend some time studying, and you're going to try to make sense out of it. That's what we got to do.
I think a lot of people put a lot of weight on Josephus, though, because he wasn't a Christian. He didn't know about this, about the prophecies necessarily that Jesus spoke here. And so this was, so if he is going to record, and he recorded things pretty meticulously, if he recorded these things, I mean, it just happened to fit with what the scriptures say, even though he wasn't that familiar with the New Testament. So yes, we do have to try to, I think it is a good idea to try to piece together what we see from history. At the same time, the historical records of that time are remarkably detailed for a podunk backwater in Palestine. And I say that even saying that people marveled at Jerusalem and the temple. And in fact, they had every right to marvel at this because this was a remarkable feat of engineering. It was a remarkable temple. And many people did comment on that. But to the people in Rome, for the most part, they didn't care that much about this sort of thing. To the pagans in Rome, I mean, not the Christians or the Jews. Obviously, they cared. So for them to have these kinds of records is still pretty remarkable. To have Josephus as his volume, The Jewish War, and so it's just an amazing thing to look at, and a wonderful thing, a wonderful companion to studying prophecy of this kind in the scripture. Keeping in mind, of course, that Josephus had his. And you're certainly right about piecing together things from history, and I certainly have had difficulty with that in the chronology class that we did a while back, especially when it came to Egypt, trying to piece that together. That was a mess. But at the same time, and at the same time, history is written by people, and people have different biases. They have different agendas, and certainly that's the case with Josephus. So we do need to take understand that what he wrote wasn't the gospel truth. It wasn't inspired. But at the same time, there are some reasons, some areas where he had no reason to lie about many of these things. So we can take him at and understand it, as long as it correlates with other facts of history. So yes, there is some difficulty certainly with trying to piece history together, and sometimes it's incomplete. Though, reading Josephus, he does tend to be fairly meticulous. I mean, in my reading, I read about the story of a boy that the Jewish soldiers, oh goodness, that he was going to come down off of a wall and was going to hand him some water, and wanted some water, and the Roman soldiers tried to get him to come down, and he said, "No, I'm not gonna come down." And they coaxed him down, and then he ran off. And they said, "Why did you run off?" Little stories like that. I mean, why even include that? But he does, and so he does tend to be very meticulous. All right, we are out of time. Oh yeah, go ahead.
I would definitely agree that Josephus is an amazing record. For one, he was an eyewitness to the destruction of Jerusalem, and he wrote about it in very meticulous ways. It's a long read and a very difficult read, the Wars of the Jews. When you read about the horrors that were going on inside of Jerusalem during the siege, that the Romans basically didn't have anything to do with because they were outside keeping people in. It was pretty awful. It was about as awful a situation as man can invent. So yeah, I would definitely recommend if someone really wants to get into this and understand the context of the destruction of Jerusalem, by all means, read Josephus.
And we'll definitely talk about that next time when we get to the tribulation aspect of this, the tribulation that's talked about in the next couple of verses, verses 19 and 20. We didn't have time to get through it today, but I did want to talk about that. In some length. So we'll talk about that next week. Thank you all for joining us. In just a few moments, we'll have our live stream for our worship service. And so please return for that in just a few moments. All right. God bless you and see you soon.